Now you're gay.
Have another beer.
No, I want to go home to my own room to sleep in my own bed. I don't want another beer.
Would you like another beer?
Oh, yeah.
I've made my choice, and I choose me.
Lover.
I can't believe that after all these years, people are still excited about the Rolling Stones.
Pay careful attention and don't look annoyed.
You are now listening to the Pop-Up Podcast. It's quite literally a podcast for whatever pops up. Here's the host of the show, director, producer, writer, and however else you know him, Pete Ferrero.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Pop-Up Podcast. This is Pete Ferrero, and I'm super excited for this week's episode. I'm going to talk one-on-one with Charles Rosen, a former executive producer of Beverly Hills 90210, regarding the time the Rolling Stones invaded Beverly Hills 90210. This seemed like it was an episode made specifically for me. It was almost like, who's that kid in Jersey that's that huge Rolling Stones fan that watches 90210 faithfully every week? This is for you. And as every week here on this pop-up podcast, this is only the second week of the show, so this is a new tradition, and we'll see if it lasts. But I open a beer and dig into an exciting interview. So this week's beer of choice, and hang on, let me open it. There we go. It's a bottle. Is a Moosehead Lager. Now, why did I pick Moosehead Lager? Is it like Keith Richards' favorite beer or something? No. I don't know what Keith Richards' favorite beer is, actually. I'm not that well-versed. Though I am a diehard Stones fan, and I do know a lot of details that are ridiculous. I picked the Moosehead Lager because a couple days before Christmas, I was shopping at a liquor store, and I am a recovering people pleaser. I am still a people pleaser, so the recovery is not going well. And a guy in line ordered three cases of this Moosehead Lager. And he looked at me and he was like, duh. You know, that was kind of the face he made. Like, how are you not getting a Moosehead Lager? And I was really just there for the Anchor Steam Christmas beers. But so when I got to the register to please this gentleman who I don't know, I said, yo, let me get a case of that Moosehead Lager too, as if I knew anything about it. But I'm going to take a sip and let you know what I think of it. That is great. Wow. It's way better than a Coors Light or a Michelob Light, I'll tell you that much. So a little bit about Charles Rosen. Charles Rosen was an executive producer on 90210, as I mentioned. And I know he wrote, and he may have produced, a Northern Exposure and a whole bunch of other shows. And I know he's a diehard Rolling Stones fan like myself. So given this is like whatever pops up, I'm always intrigued by this particular episode of 90210 because how did these worlds collide? Now, I know back in 1994 when the Stones released Voodoo Lounge, everybody was saying how old they were, which is funny because of how many years ago that was and how many years ago now that they've still been playing. So maybe it was a thing to try to be more hip and be on a television show like that. I don't know, but I'm really super excited to find out. Last week, I had a lot of fun talking to Jamie D, Carnival Cruise Director. Wow, I thought it was so interesting to find out so many of the inside scoops and behind the scenes of how a cruise really works. I did talk to a couple people this week that had spent some time in cruise jail. So, because they needed to sleep it off, and I found that very interesting. I'm not going to name names. Okay, so I'm going to take a short little break, and it's just going to be a quick ad, just plugging out where you can find the Pop-Up Podcast and more episodes and all that stuff. And when I come back, I'm going to go one-on-one with Charles Rosen. We're going to talk all things Rolling Stones and Beverly Hills 90210. So stay tuned. We'll be right back as I sip my Moosehead Lager.
Do you want more updates on the Pop-Up Podcast? Check out our website, popuppodcast.com, for all the latest episodes, upcoming guests, merchandise, and more. Or if you're more of the social type, check us out at the Pop-Up Podcast on Facebook, the Pop_Up Podcast on Instagram. Now back to the show.
So I'm so excited to have Charles Rosen here on the Pop-Up Podcast. thank you so much for doing this. I'm a 90210 super fan and a Rolling Stones super fan, so it was almost like you guys made this episode specifically for me. Right off the bat, just to confirm, that's not true. You didn't make this. You weren't like, there's this kid in Jersey we're making this episode for, right?
I have to be truthful. Of the 144 episodes that I produced, this is the one I made for me.
There you go. That's awesome.
And my friend Larry Mullen, who wrote it and who played the roadie, and we'll be talking. You'll hear his name throughout our conversation.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So you're a Rolling Stones fan growing up. I'm sure it's a big thing to you. For me, I started in '81, so I'm a Tattoo You era kid. I gather you're probably go a little bit before 1981. So what's your history of being a Stones fan?
Well, a couple of things. So in eighth grade, moving into the high school, but in eighth grade, we had a band. And I was the singer in the band. And so I played a tambourine and pranced around and imitated Mick.
There you go.
And one of our big songs, we only knew about seven songs, but The Last Time was the one that was my favorite Rolling Stone song for a long, long time. And moving into, I actually saw the Rolling Stones four different times in four different venues before we hooked up with them in Pasadena during the Voodoo Lounge tour. I'll go through them if
you
want. Yeah,
definitely. What were the four shows? I mean, is this like the Mick Taylor mid-early 70s period, or is it Ronnie?
Oh, I'm an old guy, Peter. So the first one was at the Hollywood Bowl in 1966.
Ooh, that's awesome. Brian Jones.
That's right. And I was a member. I was a baseball player all through these years in high school. And so it was our Beverly Hills All-Star Pony League that went as a group because our starting catcher's father was the general manager of the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, very cool.
So we sat in the first row.
Wow. Rolling Stones front row. Yeah.
The Hollywood Bowl has boxes. And so we had those center boxes. And what I remember most about the entire concert was not the Rolling Stones, but that the opening act got booed off the stage.
Oh my God. Who was the opening act?
The opening act was the Buffalo Springfield.
Wow. That's some
so
show.
So that's 1966. You know, where Satisfaction was the big song, of course. By 1969, you had them doing a tour to promote their Let It Bleed album.
Right.
And what they did in Los Angeles is they had at least two shows. They may have had more, but they had two shows on the same night at the Fabulous Forum where the Lakers played all those years. And we went to see the first show. You know, certainly remember, I think the highlight for me of all the music was Mick and the boys doing Midnight Rambler.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, it's a brand new song at that point.
Right.
And also what I remember about the concert is going out to the parking lot in a, with all my friends, and we definitely smoked a lot in that forum where they kept saying no smoking.
It right.
Didn't matter. and we couldn't find our car. So we kept going around the parking lot, and because we did that, we ran into Jimi Hendrix.
No so way. That's wild. That's crazy, man. That's awesome.
So that was the 69 Bowl. Now the 72 one is probably my favorite. This is the Rolling Stones went to Winterland and played four concerts, a matinee in an evening, a day off matinee in an evening. We saw the first matinee, started 4 o'clock, and, you know, can't wait. It's going to be the Rolling Stones playing their Exile on Main Street, you know, which had Sweet Virginia, you know, Thank You for Your Wine, California. And this was the first time they'd been back in the Bay Area since Altamont, the debacle of Christmas 1969. And anyway, the lights go down and the announcer says, "You knew him as Little Stevie, but he's not little anymore." And they introduced Stevie Wonder. He came out by himself. He played, sat down with his organ and synthesizer and proceeded to play the entire Music of My Mind album in order. Did not take a break. In order. Place went crazy. And the Rolling Stones stayed in their dressing room, I kid you not, for 2 hours.
Wow. Yeah.
After he finished. And surprise, surprise, Stevie Wonder wasn't on the tour after San Francisco because I can't tell you anything that the Stones played or did because it was a Stevie Wonder concert. It was his coming out concert followed by Superstition and, you know, Inner Visions and all the great albums that he made. And then the last one, what was interesting about it, from especially for a connoisseur like yourself, Peter, is that it was the 1989 in the Los Angeles Coliseum, and it was billed in the Los Angeles Times for days as a showdown between the Rolling Stones, the old venerable Rolling Stones, and their opening act, the changing of the guard, because the opening act was Guns N' Roses.
Wow, nice, yeah.
And Guns N' Roses had plenty of fans who got there really early for them, and we got there pretty early. And this is a little un-PC, so for any PC people who are out there, they may be a little unhappy about this, but I don't mean any harm. We had pretty good seats, and in right by where the sound area was, where they did all the mixing, and you know, the Memorial Coliseum is downtown, right next door to University of Southern California, and sitting in front of me and my friend, who I'll bring, his name was Brad Gross, and Brad, for 90210 Aficionados, was our first assistant director for the first three seasons, and directed some of special episodes along the way during his tenure, including one that the fans might remember called Meeting Mr. Pony. It's the one where Brenda gets held hostage at the Peach Pit.
Yes.
And he did that, stepped in and did that one. But anyway, so we're sitting behind two very clean-cut Trojan undergraduates, 20 years old, both in like nice sweaters, who proceeded to make out the whole time. It was, they were finding their inner and outer lesbian right in front of us as the show's going on. So for two guys who were, you know, pushing their late 30s, this was a very interesting element of the show.
Right.
But what I also remember about it, and believe me, Guns N' Roses was terrific, but when the Stones came out and did Start Me Up, one of the things that you learned is to how the Rolling Stones always dominated their opening acts was that they would never let their opening acts plug into their sound system. They had to bring their own sound system, which could never match.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they came out, and pretty much at the end, you thought, oh, this is the winner and undisputed champions. Still standing, the Rolling Stones.
That's right. Yeah, that's really awesome. I guess the lesbian thing is interesting because they always bring out that rock and roll, even out of that rock and roll lifestyle, even out of their audience, right?
I think so, and I mean to say, these were not rock. These, nobody would mistake these two for groupies or rock and roll chicks, but they certainly groove to the music.
They got into it for sure. Yeah. So, I mean, and now in 1994, you're working on this awesome show. And how does the Rolling Stones come into your world? How does this episode even come to your desk, and how does it come to be?
Well, it was kind of a fluke, truthfully. We had an annual meeting in 90210 that started really, I think, during our third season, our last high school year, and then transitioning to college. And what this was it was a meeting with me and a vice president, corporate vice president at Fox, who was in charge of sales. so that I could tell him the various areas that we are considering doing that might give him agita, that might make it hard on the sales department. And of course, these annual meetings came out of our battles over teenage sexuality, where after the first season, the independent standards and practices department became a division of the sales department. And in the second year, the second season that we had with some of our episodes, the condom episode,
sure,
and a few others, we, you know, there was a lot of battles about what, especially over teenage sexuality. So this meetings were done to kind of head off the acrimony that seemed to be baked into the cake.
Right.
So I'm sitting in David Grant's office when he gets called to confirm that the Rolling Stones have accepted the Fox Broadcasting Company as one of the sponsors of the Voodoo Lounge Tour. And I said, because Fox was starting their own attempt to do an internet thing, an AOL, this, they were doing their Fox One, their chat rooms, their MySpace. I don't know what it was,
yeah,
but they were starting it. And I immediately in that room with David Grant said that we're connected to him prime time. We're working with them. It's our gig. We would have never got it, because the truth is that whenever the Simpsons wanted to do anything, the Simpsons got to do it.
They're first.
So we would have not been able to, or we would have been after the fact. Let me put it that way a little bit. So from that moment, I said, you know, put us in touch with the Rolling Stones. And that's what started an incredible odyssey, a very difficult shoot for reasons that you would suspect and maybe not suspect.
Okay, so you just happened to be in the room at that time, which is, you know, the perfect timing almost. Is that Stones fan in you like, I've got to make this happen, and we've got to make, you know, like we're on this now?
Absolutely. I told David it's ours. He can't give that. There's no, you know, I don't care. If Darren Star calls, tell him, nope, Melrose Place can't have him, or whoever else was going on at the time. This was the first year of the X-Files, so they wouldn't have wanted him. But we certainly were all over it. And it was a question of, you know, how it could fit in.
That's what I was going to ask you. So this is not something that you're sort of, it's not even in the plan of what you were talking about initially, and now it kind of shows up in your world. What are some of the ideas that start coming up about what can we do with the Rolling Stones on Beverly Hills 90210?
Well, the first set of concerns are where we're going to film it.
Mm-hmm.
And we really had two choices. We had the Rolling Stones played a couple of nights in an outdoor arena where the Chargers used to play football. In San Diego, and then they did two nights in the Rose Bowl. And I forget why we wanted San Diego more. I think it had to do with just our own scheduling in terms of having it be that came a little earlier, so we could set up the episode a little earlier, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But what we knew is that we could not. The main shooting crew could not shoot the concert. We had to get another kind of special unit to shoot the concert. And I knew somebody who was very big in the music world then in terms of shooting music videos. He had won awards for one, a particular, you remember that there was a, Aerosmith shot Janie,
yeah,
got her gun.
Yes.
And Marty Colliner shot that. And he was a personal friend. Our friendship almost ended because he was not prepared to give me a break that I needed to be able to fit this into my pattern budget. And we just couldn't afford to use him and didn't know what to do. So, and you know, he was being talked about as doing a Rolling Stone special for HBO, so he kind of knew them, and it was it's time, the clock is ticking, and we got to figure out what to do. So we found another production company, small company that was acceptable to us, who could shoot it and had worked with Mick and the boys before. But the thing about Mick Jagger is the same thing that can apply to Aaron Spelling. And I think it might be endemic to people who are major stars in show business, is that they have this uncanny ability to live only in the present tense. You're my best friend now. 2 weeks later, I remember you.
Right.
That moment that the Stones needed someone there, you were going to be the savior. Well, this, he didn't want to work with somebody who had worked with him on Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, because that was a different era and a different band and, you know, different sound, and so it wasn't going to work. And our director of this particular episode, named Dave Semmel, who was our associate producer, had the idea that, well, you know, they just released a DVD of their Voodoo Lounge tour. Why don't we get the guys who shot that concert to shoot for us?
Great idea.
And they were in Los Angeles. They were a little independent company called Graying and Balding. And we called them No Answer. But we had an address for a house where theoretically one of them lived. And I drove, it was in the valley in Studio City. And I left a meeting at my house with Larry Mullen, the writer of this episode, and a fella named Steve Wasserman, who was a writer-producer of the show, because we were in there trying to figure out what we're going to do if we have to not have a Rolling Stones episode and yet have all the other subplots that are involved with the series. There's one with Dylan in Rehab. There's right. one with Brandon in Student Politics. What are we going to fill in if we can't do the Rolling Stones? We had to make that contingency.
And you had to show them, obviously, you have to see the Stones performing. So you can't just do a Rolling Stones episode without the Rolling Stones concert. So it's...
That would be a little unsatisfactory to you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
So we drove across the time, drove across town. I left the package of, you know, who we were, what we were. Well, here's the script, what we need. And fortunately, they were in town and they signed on. And so, and we were also, because we were working with the Stones through their publicist, a woman named Fran Curtis.
Okay.
At Rogers and Cowan, New York, who I believe is still involved with the Stones.
I think so, yeah.
And she, and so we dealt with her. And we were given the green light that Graying and Balding was good, and we were allowed to use the footage, some of the footage from the DVD, the concert that they shot in New Jersey.
Okay.
To start the tour. Speaking of Jersey, as we started out. So that's what we had in terms of our ability to do it. The Stones shot, they did a concert, they took a day off and they did another concert. So we shot, I can't remember if we shot in between the concerts on their day off to do some of the things that you, like for instance, you know, Steve Sanders trying to get in the concert and
right.
stuff around the periphery and Jamie Walters, Ray Pruitt telling Donna Martin that, hey, I can get you in the concert for free. We're gonna be concessionaires. All those things were shot in the middle before the concert. And then the night of the concert, the shots that Dave Semmel had to do were with the shooting crew were all laid out. You know, we shot, and so we just ended up doing those. And and then merged the two together.
So the stuff that was with Steve, you know, that's all off day. The Stones aren't there. You're getting, I don't know, extras and all this stuff to create a concert feel for that, you know, for the concert. You're not having to try to do all of this on the day of a concert.
Exactly. And also, so these were our 2 days in Pasadena. And I don't believe we did anything other. Oh, so the scene you mentioned, for those of you who haven't seen the episode recently, at a certain point, you know, our guy Ray Pruitt, Donna's working class paramour at the time, has a band and he's starting to have a career. So for him, he walks out on stage and pretends he's singing one of his songs.
Right.
And of course, that was, you know, filmed on the day they weren't there.
Right. That's interesting. I'm sure that those were not Keith Richards guitars that were on stage at that point.
No, I'm sure they came out of the Beverly Hills 90210 prop truck.
Right. But in terms of like the songs that you selected, like Jim's playing You Got Me Rocking at the top of the episode, and then It's Only Rock and Roll Plays, are you able to pick the songs that you guys want to use for the episode, or is it a back and forth with the Stones? Like, no, we would prefer you to use all of the new album stuff, or oh, this one's okay, that one's not okay. Or do you kind of have carte blanche with what you want to do?
Oh, it was worse than you could ever imagine. The guy who, there was a period of time, and I can't tell you exactly when in the Stones chronology, but that they sold their catalog to a fella named Prince Rupert. Okay. So Prince Rupert controlled virtually 95% of the catalog. And for us to use, let's say, Street Fighting Man would have been our entire budget.
Wow.
Onto it. So it wasn't going to work. But fortunately, if you think about the Voodoo Lounge Tour, the Voodoo Lounge Tour started off with Bo Diddley singing Not Fade Away.
Right.
Well, Rupert didn't own Not Fade Away. And for some quirky reason, don't ask me why, he didn't own It's Only Rock and Roll.
Oh, that is weird. Yeah.
So we had those two songs and then the Hey, Hey, You Got Me Rockin' or whatever, the one we were allowed to use. And I think there was something off the Voodoo Lounge Tour we were allowed to use. And that became our musical assembly. So we were kind of, you know, this is what you got, figure out how to use it, which is kind of be the, what the whole episode was. And then because also I know you're interested in what it was like dealing with the Rolling Stones.
Right, that was where I was going next. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and we're dealing with Fran Curtis. But then all of a sudden, somebody else steps in. I guess it's the person who's in charge of the Voodoo Lounge Tour. And he gets on the phone with our production team, Dave Semmel, the director, and our line producer, virtually my partner making the shows all those years, was named Paul Wagner. And they get a call to describe how we are allowed to film the Rolling Stones, because they said it was very important that we do never distract from the audience's enjoyment of the music in the concert. That was the ground rules. No part of that would be more followed and adhered to than obviously when they're singing on stage.
Right.
What at that point in time, before you had all this Photoshop and the different things in the digital world, my thing was, if you're going to go on location, the reason to go on location is so you can say, we were here. We were in Pasadena with the Rolling Stones, or we did an episode. We went out of town up to San Francisco. We were in San Francisco. There's the view. We're on the cable cars. You know, no matter where it was when we went out of town, that you knew we weren't faking it in a back lot, because sometimes we had to fake it in the back lot.
Totally.
Paris, and the first time Brenda and Dylan went to Mexico, they went to Malibu.
Right.
So, you know, so sometimes you had to do that, but other times you wanted to be there. So the important part was that Brandon and Andrea come late to the concert. because of Brandon's story with right. the school politics. They come late, right in time to see the Rolling Stones. And they get right up into the front because we had established in the plot point that Brandon's father, Jim Walsh, had the did something with marketing and could get them into the VIP area up in the front. So anyway, they come down, and the point was we had one shot. Mick Jagger, it was the one song, one shot. Mick Jagger was going to come down the stage, and we had to do an over-the-shoulder shot of Brandon and Andrea standing there, and you'd see Mick, you'd see them, you know, hold, cut, we were there. Okay, so it's the time to, and we can only put our lights up for that moment, up in the front. That was the only wow. time we could use any kind of lights. Remember, this was not the graying and balding, shooting all the other elements of the concert. This was our main shooting company.
Right.
And now it's that moment, and I'm standing down there. I pretty much followed the shooting company wherever they shot that day, that concert. We had a lot of friends, a lot of crew people in the stands, but I was running around the whole time. And I was down there in the front row, in the standing area off to the side, with the shooting company and Jason and Gabrielle. And now it's that big moment, and Mick starts coming down, and he's there, and he dances around, and he plays, and we get the shot, and everybody's jubilant. I'm so happy, I virtually run into the end of the shot. I said, "You're running." But I knew they had enough. They didn't have to keep it going. But anyway, right. that's how happy we were. And now we're going to fold up. And then someone goes, well, wait a second. Keith Richards is coming down. Now, Keith Richards was not supposed to come down. But if Mick's going to get his props, Keith's going to take his.
Right.
So now Keith comes down. And, and our lights are still on. Somehow the whole you know, concern about the audience went away. Keith does his. He comes back to center stage. Okay, let's close this thing up. Wait a second. Mick's coming back.
Right.
And he came down again, you know, to perform almost right in front of us. And
that's
and
cool.
That was that. And now they are done for that song. And, you know, the cast itself, most of them didn't give a rat's ass. Right. It was the Rolling Stones.
Right.
But Jason Priestley's girlfriend at the time was the actress Christine Elise, who played Emily Valentine. And she knew the music. She liked the music. And she and I, so as our crew were packing up and leaving, she and I stayed there and watched the whole show.
Oh, that's awesome.
We watched the next song. And now the next song is coming. And all of a sudden, Jason comes back and says, "Christine, let's go. I'm tired." And they leave. And I'm alone watching the Rolling Stones from about, you know, 10 yards away.
That's awesome.
But it was an awesome time. And I, you know, and the truth is, Peter, after you have an experience like that, I've never seen them since.
Oh, because nothing's going to top it. You know what I mean? You saw them in an environment that nothing could ever top that thing of seeing Mick that close and having to get the shot in a 3-minute song or whatever it was. And even milliseconds of when him decided that he was going to show up down there.
Exactly. So it was really a highlight thing. Now, here's the funny part. You know, this was their domestic tour of the Voodoo Lounge Tour. And it was nearing the end of the tour. It started in the East Coast. Now it's fall. You're in the West Coast. I think after Pasadena, they went up to Oakland, maybe Seattle, and that was it.
Right.
I get a call. Fran Curtis calls me and says, "So what we'd like from you now is to know when we're planning our international tour. We're about to start our international tour. And we want to know when this episode is going to air around the world." And I said, "I have no idea."
Right.
Because, you know, how it was is that in the first season, we had very few countries by the and territories, you know, actually by the privilege of airing Aaron Spelling's latest high school show, first high school show since Mod Squad. And, you know, so all we got was really Canada, Australia, and England. And I think maybe another country here and there. But once we became that international hit, or there was some interest there, they all jumped on. And then our the countries where we were the biggest fans, they came even after that, which was Italy and Spain. The three countries in the world we were biggest fans was Italy, Spain, and Israel. They were our best four. And then, I mean, we had fans everywhere else,
of course.
Believe me, but those three were where the rabid fans were. So I had to say to Fran Curtis, I have no idea, because it varies from country to country. Silence on the phone.
Oh,
silence. Because that's the one question she didn't ask me the whole time we were planning it. Had she asked me, I don't know if we would have ever gotten the right, you know, they would have
correct
backed out.
Right. Yeah, because it would only have been in one area of the
That's art, right. If it isn't good for Mick and the Rolling Stones, we ain't doing it.
Now, the stuff with Claire and David doing all of the trolling, which is, I think, the first time there is a the trolling on television, you know, trolling the message boards and all that stuff. I guess my question is, did the Stones see that? Do they read the script? Do they say, oh, we don't want these age jokes in here? Or are they okay with it because they're trying to appeal to this younger audience?
I would imagine that we, you know, it's a little, that question, good question. It's a little vague in my mind all these years later.
Right.
But they would have asked for the script. It would have shown them the script.
Sure.
And I would have made any changes they would have asked. And I don't believe they asked those. They asked any changes on that. I'm not sure. I mean, Fran Curtis may have read them, but I'm not sure anybody else in the organization did. But I want to just remind, before we go on to Jamie, I just want to remind you about the using, you know, the internet and chat rooms and things. Well, that was pretty brand new. And remember, Fox had just was launching theirs.
Right.
So that was one of the reasons that we wanted to take advantage of that. And we, in our fifth season, we started to, you needed to have episodes that could be standalone episodes with a beginning, middle, and end that all of our serialized stories could float into. That was what was preferred. Otherwise, all the serialized stuff starts to get lost, and you just have none of the shows are really distinctive. What happens to the characters in that might make it distinctive, but there's no specific story that lights it up.
Right.
And so the Stones fit into that. We did one later. We spoofed The Real World.
Yes,
and we
I remember
did the
that.
Same thing. So we tried to stay attuned to what was going on in, you know, the pop culture all around us, as particularly Larry Mullen, who wrote this script and played the roadie.
Right.
He wrote that script with me. He kept saying, put your name on this with me. And I did that a lot, but I didn't do it on this one.
Oh, I don't know. I feel like being the Stones fan, you may have should have done, gone for that one.
Well, you know, remember when we finally, he went and was going above and beyond the call of duty because he was writing a script. He wasn't sure we were going to even be able
Fair
to
Fair enough.
Do.
Right. Sure.
I could have shared story credit for sure. But
yeah.
Larry wrote the script. But anyway, he was into digital and things like that. So, and it's a very interesting, just to do a sidebar for a second, you know, chat room started in the 90s.
That's right.
And one of the first chat rooms that was out here in computer was called that came to my attention, our attention was called Prodigy. So there we are in our first season and, near the end, now we're becoming this kind of, you know, the America's finding us, and it's, you know, we're moving to becoming a real, real hit and pretty solid show. And we realize, wait a second, they're talking about this in this thing called a chat room, so that we could see firsthand what our fans were saying about our show. And we use that to our advantage. Negotiating with the network until they caught on what we, that, hey, you know, there's a chat room about you. Yeah, we did. So chat rooms have always factored into the 90210 experience.
And there's even episodes later on where, you know, they drop I think actually the very next episode they're back into the chat room and you know they're talking about the house party and all that stuff. Right. So you guys were totally on board with, and even as the season shows moved on, as different technology formed, you guys were definitely always at the forefront of using that technology for certain.
Correct. Now, I'm going to tell you something that's going to blow your mind, because you're talking about, you said the next episode, and for fans of the show, and I presume a couple of them will be listening, they'll know that the episode that came after was one of the iconic episodes we did in the fifth year. That was the fire episode.
Right.
Both the fire episode and the Rolling Stones episode were part of something we had called Double Ups, where we filmed two episodes at the same time.
Wow.
Filmed them, edited them, and prepped them at the same time.
Wow. Those are two big episodes to have to be, have to focus. Well,
you got it. And that's because, you know, in those days, the networks had, and the station groups had a particular interest in the ratings in the months of November, February, and May. Those were called sweep months, the sweeps. And what your ratings were in that month affected not the network so much, but affected what the local stations could charge based on the viewership in that period of time. So there was a lot of special kind of stunt casting and special episodes and this, and so the Stones fell into that, as did, of course, the fire episode.
Right. And just real quick, we talked about Emily Valentine. Was there ever a thought, because, you know, Jason was dating her, and was there ever a thought at some point, like, let's maybe bring her back? Because she was starting to become, you know, she came back a couple of times. Was there ever a thought of bringing that character back to the show? Or was it always just kind of one-offs?
Well, one off, two off, you know, a little arc, story arcs and things. Well, we always, when you have as many episodes as we have to do, and you had as many plot points going on and messages flowing through and different things, we would have to come to that minimalist adage that less is more. And so we felt that, you know, a little of Emily Valentine would go a long way. Christine herself ended up writing being credited writing an episode, as I was the producer on the later in the season, which was the episode we did when Andrea went on College Jeopardy.
Oh, interesting.
And we actually were on the set with Alex Trebek. Right. Another, you know, big step. And that's the nature of stunt casting right there, right?
Yeah.
You know, going in May. But and so she ended up, I think the next year, she was on a staff as a writer, but I was gone.
I got you. And it's always been interesting to me that, you know, and the beauty in some of the 90210 writing that Emily would visit and Kelly would wind up in a fire, given the history with the fire in Emily's episode all those few years prior. You know, so there was always like that beautiful symmetry or whatever in the writing on 90210 that I don't.
Well, we tried, you know, anything to cause our characters to be guilty after the fact. We right. wanted to do it. Yeah.
And why doesn't Jenny Garth participate in seeing the show? She's upstairs. She doesn't go. She's one of the only characters that doesn't go to the floor and watch the show. I think Claire and David watched the show, or Claire and. Claire and David watched the show, and Donna and Ray watched the show, but she's up in a booth.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and if I remember correctly, at that point she had started to do the modeling already.
Okay.
And she started to build that up, and later in the season, post fire, she you know, was on the cover of 17 magazine, et cetera, et cetera. And but at this point they were telling her, you should go to this event.
Right.
So she was there separately than all the others to be at an event, and she had homework to do, and she didn't particularly care about being there. And you know, the thing about the VIP areas a lot
right.
is that they are whatever the event is, it tends to be a little, you know, as it pertains to the public, a little standoffish, mm-hmm. a little elitist.
Right.
And our show was called Beverly Hills 90210.
Totally.
So that was an element, you know, that was kind of there. And Jenny, you know, is a person, no offense, I love and admire her, what she did this summer with the reboot, quite a bit. But she was a little standoffish.
Right.
So
okay,
it was
yeah.
exactly who she, we had her do what we felt she would do. It also, by her being in the VIP room, she could vouch that Steve Sanders belonged there when he finally got in and tried to break the barrier and become a big shot.
And there's this whole thing with Dylan, you know, obviously he's in rehab and recovery. And was there always a plan to like, okay, Dylan's going to be in rehab. But then once the Stones episode sort of comes your way and now we're doing this, it does seem like kind of perfect that you know, given their rock and roll history as well, that the Stones hat played into it. So was it always like Dylan's going to be in rehab at this point and now we can do this thing with the Stones?
Well, we were developing them concurrently. You know, the thing that when I would be interviewed at the time, no matter who I was talking to, it was whether it was Entertainment Weekly or a local newspaper, whatever it would be, I would just keep reminding people, you know, we're just kind of making this up as we go along. And
right.
That was the case here. And we knew it was a good fit. We knew it was about the right time. And that's why we went to such lengths to keep it all intact one of the reasons to keep it all intact when we realized that we may not have any way to actually have a company to film the Stones.
Right. A few more. Does Charlie, the character Charlie, get his name from Charlie Watts, or is it just a name that they picked out?
From Charlie Rosen, I think.
Oh. So you guys were doing some, I would always once in a while see like Pettit was a last name used a lot. Was that somebody that's on staff? You guys are using personal names and
Christine,
whatnot?
Christine Pettit was my assistant in years 2 and 3. And Christine wrote the, with her writing partner at the time, Roseanne Welch, wrote one of the episodes having to do with Andrea and having a premature baby in year 4.
There's even a line in one of the episodes where someone says this is Pettit's little brother too. So you guys were using her name.
Oh, of course. You used,
yeah, I love that. I love
friends' names. My high school reunion's coming up and I remember coming to one of my reunions after the show and a woman I knew, I used her name, you know, Kate Grubin. Hello, Kate, if you're listening.
Right.
I used her name. She just, and we weren't even that good of friends, quite frankly. We were in choir together. We sang together, but, you know.
It was a great name. Yeah.
Didn't hang out, but I liked her name. I used her name, and she was real thrilled about that, and that's our bond whenever I see her or Facebook back and forth.
That's pretty cool. Okay, does Alex Diaz, the character, own another jean jacket or another jacket? How does that come to be that he's always wearing that jean jacket? Is it the denim jacket? Is it just is it a wardrobe thing? We always identify him as this is Alex Diaz because he's not a main character? How does something like you're going to be in the denim jacket? How does that come up?
Okay, well, good question. Here's a couple of but first I want you to know, I didn't know when we were starting our conversation whether this was going to be taped or filmed. So I actually got off, put on my blue jean jacket in solidarity with Alex Diaz. You viewers can't see it, but I got it on, trust right. me. One of the things, there are two reasons, there are two things to say about that. One is, three really, and one of them was the exact idea. The guy in the blue jacket makes him identifiable.
Totally.
And I didn't think about that at all, but it works out, and it probably was the smartest reason to keep him in that blue jacket. The other is that you've only got so much money to make shows, whether it was, because like when we started out with 90210, in our first two seasons, we had the lowest license fee in television and spent less money than any other show in primetime. That wasn't such an issue by the college years, but at the same time, we were trying to, you know, you always try to look for, well, we don't have to spend money on this, on this. So one of the areas, especially when we were straddling the line and trying to keep our shows within the budget that we were allowed to use, I made it pretty clear that I didn't care at all what the characters wore. That as far as I'm concerned, you know, teenagers wear blue jeans and t-shirts.
Right.
Mr. Spelling, of course, had a different viewpoint to wardrobe. And pretty much I ceded wardrobe to him, to be honestly truthful. I didn't, it just didn't mean that much to me. I knew it meant a lot to the fashionistas and
totally.
People were following, particularly, you know, Brenda and Kelly and Tori, what they were wearing. But, you know, I figured that we hired a costume wardrobe supervisors and they would figure out what they were going to be wearing. We didn't end up loving our first one for the first 12. She did the pilot. She was a little too New York-y and kitschy. And then we had a really terrific woman for a couple of years named Diane Kennedy. And then she... not easy to do wardrobe with our team, our actresses.
I would imagine.
And so, but then another one came in after, and she was one nice personality, Canadian named Molly Campbell. And she was the one during this. So maybe she could tell you why Alex Diaz
right.
wore the same blue jacket. But I think it was just, it made it just easier. This is Alex jacket. This is what you should be wearing.
Fair enough. I think that makes the most sense. The Let It Bleed line, I think Jim says something, save the Let It Bleed record for me. Who wrote that line?
Larry Mullen.
So that's his thing, I guess, that's his album that of choice.
He said that, it might be, but that I don't know if it was his album of choice. You remember, Larry's even a couple of years older than me, so... You know, we go back, I remember, you know, the albums where they would sing like Everybody Needs Somebody
yeah.
to Love or Let's Spend a Night Together. So we go back, you know, to Satisfaction. So, and even before then, the Stones did a lot of blues albums. Their original, they sang the blues.
Totally.
Spider to the Fly is an old blues song, right? And they Mick and Keith were into the blues. And so like so many of the English acts at the time. I don't know if that was his favorite. My favorite I don't think it was my favorite at the time, but in hindsight, the one that I seem to like listen to hits off YouTube and things like that is Beggar's Banquet.
I do love that. I think my favorite is probably Sticky Fingers with the Can't You Hear Me Knocking and Brown Sugar and all that stuff.
And Brown Sugar.
Yep.
Well, Sticky Fingers would be right up there.
And so lastly, after this season, you do a little Mick Taylor of yourself and you leave 90210. So what is the reason that you left after that season?
We produced 32 hours of television in the last 2 years. We did double ups, which means that you had 6 episodes going on at one time. I had a very small staff. And in December, I had a premonition that the show was trying to kill me. And even though I was only 42 at the time when I had the premonition, I knew I could not sustain this kind of pressure
mm-hmm.
and schedule. And I let Mr. Spelling know that January that I was not coming back. He never forgave me. Tried to once sell me to come back in a very intimidating way. He never forgave me for leaving. But as I would remind him the few times we saw each other afterwards, when he'd always ask me, did I leave? Because he, Mr. Spelling was very important to me. We worked very closely together, but at the same time, he was a narcissist and everything was always about Aaron. Everything came back to him. Maybe he wasn't as much, you know, into the extreme that Trump is.
Right.
But at the same time, when Trump was running, it took me about 3 weeks to realize, God, who does he remind me of? Yeah. But not to the extreme, and Mr. Spelling was not a bigot like that.
Right, absolutely.
For sure. But the you know, so in that, I had to tell Aaron I was leaving, and he'd always ask me, did you leave because of me, lover? And I said, no, Aaron, I left because I had a premonition that I was going to die. And indeed, I left the show in mid-May, and in early July, July 3rd, 1995, to be exact, I'm 43 years old, and my artery shuts down.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And fortunately, that's all those years later, I have not had heart trouble. I had no heart disease in my family. I had no problems, physical problems before then. It just was the stress of doing the show. So, you know, talk about Let It Bleed. I guess I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, man, thanks so much for covering this episode. I think this was really awesome. I had a lot of fun talking about it, and I love that you're a Stones fan and whatnot. Anything else that we missed maybe that you want to add about this and this experience?
Oh, sure. I think we'll put it all in perspective.
Yeah.
In season 5, this was the lowest rated show we did.
Oh, no.
Well, the show was, and one of the reasons was, is this, don't take it so personally, but one of the reasons was, is because it was on, we in those years were airing on a Wednesday night. And they aired this on a Wednesday night the day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And our audience is flying to see their relatives at that point.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, but you did get this awesome experience of working with the Stones, and you can certainly say that you got
to. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as a producer, you know, we always talk, oh, he was a writer. He was the writer. But as far as having the notion of producing, as I say, this was my favorite. The only two that even required as much emphasis and was a lot of fun in that regard was the one where we did the big carnival at the end of season 4. Mm-hmm. And of course, the one where we blew up the car.
Yeah, those are really awesome ones. And hopefully one day we'll get a chance to dive back in on some of the stuff with you.
Let me know. I'll do it.
Absolutely, man. Thanks so much for being here. It was great connecting. One of the ways you guys may know me is from my pro wrestling documentary on the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase called The Price of Fame. And I wanted everybody to know about a really awesome convention that's coming to New Jersey on April 18th at I Play America. It's going to feature wrestlers like The Honky Tonk Man and Zeus, and Lex Luger and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, The Rock and Roll Express. I saw Ted Arcidi, who is on that list. That's pretty cool. The Haiti Kid, and Sean Mooney, and so many more. To find out more about this event, go to 80swrestlingcon.com. Again, that's the 80swrestlingcon.com website for more information about their convention on April 18th at iPlay America in New Jersey. So there you have it. Charles Rosen, executive producer of Beverly Hills 90210, digging deep with me on the Rock of Ages episode. Wow, there was so much meat on the bones in that episode. I want to do way, way more with Charles Rosen. I love 90210. I love talking about production. I love talking about film. It's sort of what I do. So hearing just the idea of how some of that went was just absolutely incredible. It's interesting, I've read almost all of the 90210 books, Jason's and Tori Spelling's and Jenny Garth's. And I know that Jason was a Stones fan. I know he mentioned that somewhere, and he had a meeting with Mick Jagger and whatnot. What a cool, cool episode to hear all that information. At any rate, so talking more about film is definitely something we're going to do on this podcast. And the plan is, as of next week, we are going to talk with Joey D'Onofrio, who was in, or D'Onofrio, depending on how you say it, at home, who was in A Bronx Tale. And we are going to dig deep in his experience being a child actor, working with Robert De Niro and Chaz. And we're gonna dig deep into his experience of that film, because it's one of my favorites for sure. And then in the coming weeks, we're still booking out some really awesome interviews. I think at some point I'm going to do a making of The Price of Fame, the documentary I did. I'm going to try to either have someone like join me here and ask me questions, or I'm still figuring out what that episode looks like. Got some very cool guests over the next couple of months, so all that's sort of falling in place right now as we speak, and I definitely would like to have Charles Rosen back. But thank you very much again for listening to another edition of the Pop-Up Podcast, and I will catch you next week.
Today's episode of the Pop-Up Podcast was brought to you by Sunspot Films. Thanks for listening. For updates, check out popuppodcast.com.